We are waiting to see how, if at all, President Trump addresses the leadership at the Defense Department.
One U.S. official tells NPR that the search is underway to replace Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Publicly, the president is standing behind him after a tumultuous week. Hegseth's office fired some of his aides. Then came revelations that the secretary shared details of impending airstrikes in Yemen again. NPR confirmed this second chat on the messaging app Signal, which included Hegseth's wife, his brother, and his personal lawyer. The first chat was with top officials and a journalist who was inadvertently included.
NPR's Quill Lawrence is here to tell us more. Quill, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So we'll note that you're reporting this story with our colleague Tom Bowman. What are you guys hearing?
Yeah, a U.S. official told us that the search has begun after this second round of headlines about Hegseth. I should add that the White House has said our anonymous source doesn't know what they're talking about. But at a Rose Garden event yesterday, the president stood firmly by Hegseth, at least publicly.
No, he's doing a great job. It's just fake news. They just bring up stories. I guess it's, it sounds like disgruntled employees. You know, he was put there to get rid of a lot of bad people, and that's what he's doing.
Quill, that phrase, disgruntled employees. I think Hegseth used a similar phrase in his public remarks about this and referred to people who were fired in his office. What's he talking about?
Yeah, there were four senior advisors to Hegseth who left in just the past week. Former Defense Department spokesman John Elliott resigned last week and then published a quite extraordinary opinion piece calling the past month at the Pentagon a, quote, full-blown meltdown, and saying that this infighting is hurting President Trump. He served in Trump's first administration. It appears to want to continue to serve. Three other Pentagon advisors, Colin Carroll, Dan Caldwell, and Darren Selnick, were escorted out of the Pentagon and accused of leaking information to the press. They then put out, as a trio, the three of them put out a joint statement on X saying that their dismissal was unconscionable and that they haven't even been told what they stand accused of leaking. They all three of them served in uniform. They say they understand the importance of information security. Caldwell and Selnick, notably, are longtime associates of Hegseth. They've worked with him over a decade back to when he was at Concerned Veterans for America, a policy group.
So I'm trying to figure out what all of this adds up to. The White House does appear to be backing Hegseth, but he's been revealed. NPR has confirmed the original New York Times report that there was a second chat group on Signal where he was sharing information about an impending attack.
Yeah, I mean, with the first chat group, it was against Pentagon policy to use Signal for that. There were a lot of security issues with it, discussing details of an attack hours before the bombs hit in Yemen. But the people in that chat were the vice president, the secretary of state, people who would need to know. This second group, it appears that Hegseth was just cut and pasting this actionable intelligence about U.S. strikes to his wife. People who just, I can't think of any conceivable need they would have to know this information. And military sources, veterans I talked to, are just outraged about this. They say that it really did put U.S. lives at risk and American security at risk. And they're concerned that this example being set, you know, the military really drills into troops that they have to take responsibility for their actions, own up. And so far, Hegseth has not done that yet for either of these Signal chats.
Yeah, and I guess we should emphasize Hegseth's side has insisted no classified information was shared, leaning on how they define classified information, but it was information about an impending attack, which is always considered sensitive. Quill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR's Quill Lawrence. And since we mentioned Signal, we will also mention that NPR's CEO chairs the board of the nonprofit Signal Foundation, which we cover like any other entity. Church bells tolled from Notre Dame in Paris to the Philippines for the death of Pope Francis.
He died on Monday at 88 years old after leading the Catholic Church's 1.4 billion followers. Tributes have poured in from around the world remembering Jorge Mario Bergoglio, the first pope from Latin America, as a leader who advocated for the poor and the dispossessed.
Gloria Patri et Filio.
In Rome, the faithful gathered for rosary prayers for Francis, and preparations are underway for his funeral.
NPR's Ruth Sherlock is in Rome. Hi there, Ruth.
Hi, good morning.
What are you hearing from people in St. Peter's Square?
There's real emotion and a sense of loss. You know, many were in tears at the rosary prayers last night. But Steve, people are also talking about Francis's legacy, about what he stood for in his 12 years as Pope. This is Ruth Angeletti from Montana.
His concern for others and the world, the environment, but concern for other people and trying to set an example.
Part of that example was to his own church. Francis famously derided the wealth and the lace and the frills that come with the papacy. He'd wear simpler outfits, he kept his plastic watch, travelled in a small Fiat car, promoting this idea of a less ornate, gold-laden church. And then he was also an advocate for migrants and the environment and seen as being friendlier to the LGBTQ faithful. He's been accused, though, of not making substantial enough changes to the church. Here's Ian Kilroy from Ireland.
I think Francis was too radical for the conservatives in the church and not radical enough for the reformers in the church. But certainly his impulse was towards reform within Catholicism, and he will be remembered for that.
So even among regular people, you can kind of see the debates taking shape on what his future legacy might be.
Yeah, it's been fascinating to reflect on how much he changed the tone of the church without changing the underlying rules of the church.
Yeah, exactly.
And now we go on to the funeral and a selection. What are you hearing about the next few days?
His body will be moved to St. Peter's Basilica, where people could come to see him from Wednesday. Previous popes were placed in these three nested coffins standing on an elevated bier for the public viewing. But Francis has ordered that he'll be put in a single wooden coffin, and it's going to be positioned facing the church pews. His funeral will be Saturday. Of course, many people will come from all around the world, including President Trump.
And then what about the conclave that comes after?
Well, it's the largest conclave in history. Pope Francis has appointed 108 of the 135 cardinals who can vote in that conclave. Here's Austin Ivory, Pope Francis's biographer.
He's appointed so many cardinals who are from far-flung places, often with very small Catholic populations, who are on the frontier of interreligious dialogue or war or suffering, or anyway, the realities of the world, so that they bring those realities into the room.
So even if Francis chooses cardinals with a similar outlook, experts say many will still differ in view on some of the huge range of issues, and there's really no guarantee that the conclave will choose a more liberal pope like Francis.
Yeah, it's a fascinating choice to be watching. NPR's Ruth Sherlock, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court considers a question about public schools.
Right. That question is whether and when parents should be allowed to pull their kids out of class over religious objections. Can parents pick and choose different bits of the curriculum, taking education a la carte?
NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is covering this case. Hi, Nina.
Hi there, Steve.
So what are the basics of the case before the court?
At the center of the case is the school system in our own nearby Montgomery County, Maryland, and it's the most religiously diverse county in the United States of America. It has 160,000 students of almost all faiths. And on one side are parents who want to opt their elementary and middle school children out of classes when those classes include storybooks with LGBTQ characters and themes. And the parents contend that the books expose their children to ideas that contradict their religious values. I talked to Grace Morrison, who's one of the parents who's suing the school system. Her daughter was 10 when the LGBTQ books were introduced in their curriculum.
Okay.
So rather than risk exposure to the unwanted ideas, Morrison is homeschooling her daughter, and here she is.
It's just very heartbreaking to me how many parents feel like they have to choose between educating their child and raising their children in their faith.
And what she really wants to do is to have her kid in the public school and be able to say that when certain material is discussed at all, the kid will be opted out of class and go to a different classroom.
Has the school board made any effort to accommodate that point of view?
Well, the board initially did allow opt-outs, but it says it became just unmanageable. Unlike a sex ed class, for example, where the school system does allow opt-outs, the board says it became a logistical nightmare to take children out of a classroom when a single storybook that features some same-sex parent or gay and lesbian kids could come up at any time. And then there's the question of, where do you draw the line? Could parents opt their kids out of a science class? where Darwin's theory of evolution is being taught, or a history class where there's a section on how women got out of the kitchen and into the workforce. These are things that are against some people's religious views.
Well, what is the law set up to now before this case?
Well, I talked to Yale law professor Justin Driver, who's written extensively about the history of public schools, and he says that generally these curriculum decisions are left to local school boards unless there's some effort to coerce students into accepting a religious belief. He defends the way the Montgomery County system has handled this issue.
It seems to me that the process is working as it should, rather than empowering individual parents or students to be able to control it. People have raised objections. The school district has heard those objections and modified their practice.
So we've heard the facts of this case. We've heard a little bit of the history. What happens when you take those facts and that history and put it before these particular nine justices?
Well, answering that question is dangerous, you know. My guess is that a majority of the justices will side with the objectors who want an opt-out, but that's not a certainty. I draw that conclusion mainly because a majority of the court has had little exposure to attending a public school themselves. I don't know where they sent their kids to school, but only three of the justices went to public schools. The other six all attended private Catholic schools.
Nina, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR's Nina Totenberg. Today, we're also following a lawsuit filed by Harvard University. The nation's wealthiest school is challenging President Trump's administration, which froze more than $2 billion in grants for research. The administration asserts that it wants to crack down on anti-Semitism. It made wide-ranging demands on Harvard, for example, learning the political views of students and professors, and screening international students for those who are, quote, hostile to American values. Harvard argues there's no rational connection between anti-Semitism concerns that grew out of protests in the last couple of years and the scientific and technological research funds that were frozen. The university frames the government's demands as a threat to its independence.